Generating power from lightning is like building a wind farm whose blades are turned by a tornado. Awesome, impractical. In case you're curious, yes, I did run some numbers on using passing tornadoes to run wind turbines, and it's even less practical than gathering lightning. The average location in the heart of Tornado Alley has a tornado pass over it only every 4,000 years. Even if you managed to absorb all the accumulated energy of the tornado, it would still result in less than a watt of average power output in the long run. Believe it or not, something like this idea has actually been attempted. A company called Avatech has proposed building a vortex engine that would produce artificial tornadoes and use them to generate power. Trevor's Lightning. In Trevor's scenario, all the lightning in the world hits in one place. This would make power generation a lot more attractive. By happened in the same place, let's assume the lightning bolts all come down in parallel, right up against each other. The main channel of a lightning bolt, the part that's carrying current, is about a centimeter or two in diameter. Our bundle contains about a million separate bolts, which means it will be about 6 meters in diameter. Every science writer always compares everything to the atomic bomb dropped on Hiroshima, so we may as well get that out of the way. Niagara Falls has a power output equal to a Hiroshima-sized bomb going off every 8 hours. The atomic bomb dropped on Nagasaki had an explosive power equal to 1.3 Hiroshima bombs. For context, the gentle breeze blowing across a prairie also carries roughly the kinetic energy of a Hiroshima bomb. The lightning bolt would deliver about 2 atomic bombs worth of energy to the air and the ground. From a more practical standpoint, this is enough electricity to power a game console and plasma TV for several million years. Or, to put it another way, it could support the U.S.'s electricity consumption for 5 minutes. The bolt itself would be only as narrow as the center circle of a basketball court, but it would leave a crater the size of the entire court. Within the bolt, the air would turn to high-energy plasma. The light and heat from the bolt would spontaneously ignite surfaces for miles around. The shockwave would flatten trees and demolish buildings. All in all, the Hiroshima comparison is not far off. Could we protect ourselves? Lightning rods. The mechanism by which lightning rods work is disputed. Some people claim they actually ward off lightning strikes by bleeding charge from the ground to the air, lowering the cloud-to-ground voltage potential and reducing the probability of a strike. The National Fire Protection Association does not currently endorse this idea. I'm not sure what the NFPA would say about Trevor's massive lightning bolts, but a lightning rod wouldn't protect you from it. A copper cable, a meter in diameter, could, in theory, conduct the brief surge of current from the bolt without melting. Unfortunately, when the bolt reached the bottom end of the rod, the ground wouldn't conduct it so well, and the explosion of molten rock would demolish your house all the same. Your house would already be catching fire anyway, thanks to the thermal radiation from plasma in the air.
What if we tried less power?
Catatumbo lightning. Collecting all the world's lightning into one place is obviously impossible. What about gathering all the lightning from just one area? No place on Earth has constant lightning. But there's an area in Venezuela that comes close. Near the southwestern edge of Lake Maracaibo, there's a strange phenomenon, perpetual nighttime thunderstorms. There are 2 spots, one over the lake and one over land to the west, where thunderstorms form almost every night. These storms can generate a flash of lightning every 2 seconds, making Lake Maracaibo the lightning capital of the world. If you somehow managed to channel all the bolts from a single night of Catatumbo thunderstorms down through a single lightning rod and used it to charge a massive capacitor, it would store up enough power to run a game console and plasma TV for roughly a century. Since there's no cellular data coverage on the southwest shore of Lake Maracaibo, you'll have to buy service through a satellite provider, which generally means hundreds of milliseconds of lag. Of course, if this happened, the old saying would need even more revision. Well, you know what they say, lightning always strikes in the same place. That place is in Venezuela.
You shouldn't stand there.
Chapter 53. Loneliest Human. Question. What is the farthest one human being has ever been from every other living person? Were they lonely? Brian J. McCarter. Answer. It's hard to know for sure. The most likely suspects are the six Apollo Command Module pilots who stayed in lunar orbit during a moon landing. Mike Collins, Dick Gordon, Stu Roosa, Al Worden, Ken Mattingly, and Ron Evans. Each of these astronauts stayed alone in the command module while two other astronauts landed on the moon. At the highest point in their orbit, they were about 3,585 kilometers from their fellow astronauts. From another point of view, this was the farthest the rest of humanity has ever managed to get from those jerk astronauts. You'd think astronauts would have a lock on this category, but it's not so cut and dried. There are a few other candidates who come pretty close. Polynesians. It's hard to get 3,585 kilometers from a permanently inhabited place. Because of the curve of the Earth, you actually have to go 3,619 kilometers across the surface to qualify. The Polynesians, who were the first humans to spread across the Pacific, might have managed it, but this would have required a lone sailor to travel awfully far ahead of everyone else. It may have happened, perhaps by accident, when someone was carried far from their group by a storm, but we're unlikely to ever know for sure. Once the Pacific was colonized, it got a lot harder to find regions of the Earth's surface where someone could achieve 3,585-kilometer isolation. Now that the Antarctic continent has a permanent population of researchers, it's almost certainly impossible. Antarctic explorers. During the period of Antarctic exploration, a few people have come close to beating the astronauts, and it's possible one of them actually holds the record. One person who came very close was Robert Scott. Robert Falcon Scott was a British explorer who met a tragic end. Scott's expedition reached the South Pole in 1911, only to discover that Norwegian explorer Roald Amundsen had beaten him there by several months. The dejected Scott and his companions began their trek back to the coast, but they all died while crossing the Ross Ice Shelf. The last surviving expedition member would have been, briefly, one of the most isolated people on Earth. Amundsen's expedition had left the continent by then. However, he, whoever he was still within 3,585 kilometers of a number of humans, including some other Antarctic explorer outposts, as well as the Maori on Rakiura, Stewart Island, in New Zealand. There are plenty of other candidates. Pierre-François Perron, a French sailor, says he was marooned on Île Amsterdam in the southern Indian Ocean. If so, he came close to beating the astronauts, but he wasn't quite far enough from Mauritius, southwestern Australia, or the edge of Madagascar to qualify. We'll probably never know for sure. It's possible that some shipwrecked 18th century sailor drifting on a lifeboat in the Southern Ocean holds the title of most isolated human. However, until some clear piece of historic evidence pops up, I think the six Apollo astronauts have a pretty good claim. Which brings us to the second part of Brian's question. Were they lonely? Loneliness. After returning to Earth, Apollo 11 Command Module pilot Mike Collins said he did not feel at all lonely. He wrote about the experience in his book, Carrying the Fire, An Astronaut's Journeys. Far from feeling lonely or abandoned, I feel very much a part of what is taking place on the lunar surface. I don't mean to deny a feeling of solitude. It is there, reinforced by the fact that radio contact with the Earth abruptly cuts off at the instant I disappear behind the moon. I'm alone now, truly alone, and absolutely isolated from any known life. I am it. If a count were taken, the score would be 3 billion plus two over on the other side of the moon, and one plus God knows what on this side. Al Worden, the Apollo 15 Command Module pilot, even enjoyed the experience. There's a thing about being alone, and there's a thing about being lonely, and they're two different things. I was alone, but I was not lonely. My background was as a fighter pilot in the Air Force, then as a test pilot, and that was mostly in fighter airplanes, so I was very used to being by myself. I thoroughly enjoyed it. I didn't have to talk to Dave and Jim anymore. On the back side of the moon, I didn't even have to talk to Houston, and that was the best part of the flight. Introverts understand. The loneliest human in history was just happy to have a few minutes of peace and quiet. Weird and worrying questions from the What If inbox, number 11. Question. What if everyone in Great Britain went to one of the coasts and started paddling? Could they move the island at all? Ellen Eubanks. No. Question. Are fire tornadoes possible? Seth Wishman. Yes. Fire tornadoes are a real thing that actually happens. Nothing I say could possibly add to this. Chapter 54. Raindrop. Question. What if a rainstorm dropped all of its water in a single giant drop? Michael McNeil. Answer. It's midsummer in Kansas. The air is hot and heavy. Two old-timers sit on the porch in rocking chairs. On the horizon to the southwest, ominous-looking clouds begin to appear. The towers build as they draw closer, the tops spreading out into an anvil shape. They hear the tinkling of wind chimes as a gentle breeze picks up. The sky begins to darken. Moisture. Air holds water. If you walled off a column of air from the ground up to the top of the atmosphere and then cooled the column of air down, the moisture it contained would condense out as rain. If you collected the rain in the bottom of the column, it would fill it to a depth of anywhere from 0 to a few dozen centimeters. That depth is what we call the air's total precipitable water, TPW. Normally, the TPW is 1 or 2 centimeters. Satellites measure this water vapor content for every point on the globe, producing some truly beautiful maps. Well, imagine our storm measures 100 kilometers on each side and has a high TPW content of 6 centimeters. This means the water in our rainstorm would have a volume of 100 kilometers times 100 kilometers times 6 centimeters equals 0.6 cubic kilometers. That water would weigh 600 million tons, which happens to be about the current weight of our species. Normally, a portion of this water would fall, scattered, as rain, at most 6 centimeters of it. In this storm, all that water instead condenses into one giant drop, a sphere of water over a kilometer in diameter. We'll assume it forms a couple of kilometers above the surface, since that's where most rain condenses. The drop begins to fall. For 5 or 6 seconds, nothing is visible. Then, the base of the cloud begins to bulge downward. For a moment, it looks a little like a funnel cloud is forming. Then the bulge widens, and at the 10-second mark, the bottom of the drop emerges from the cloud. The drop is now falling at 90 meters per second, 200 miles per hour. The roaring wind whips up the surface of the water into spray. The leading edge of the droplet turns to foam as air is forced into the liquid. If it kept falling for long enough, these forces would gradually disperse the entire droplet into rain. Before that can happen, about 20 seconds after formation, the edge of the droplet hits the ground. The water is now moving at over 200 meters per second, 450 miles per hour. Right under the point of impact, the air is unable to rush out of the way fast enough, and the compression heats it so quickly that the grass would catch fire if it had time. Fortunately for the grass, this heat only lasts a few milliseconds because it's doused by the arrival of a lot of cold water. Unfortunately for the grass, the cold water is moving at over half the speed of sound. If you were floating in the center of this sphere during this episode, you wouldn't have felt anything unusual up until now. It'd be pretty dark in the middle, but if you had enough time and lung capacity to swim a few hundred meters out toward the edge, you'd be able to make out the dim glow of daylight. As the raindrop approached the ground, the buildup of air resistance would lead to an increase in pressure that would make your ears pop. But seconds later, when the water contacted the surface, you'd be crushed to death. The shock wave would briefly create pressures exceeding those at the bottom of the Mariana Trench. The water plows into the ground, but the bedrock is unyielding. The pressure forces the water sideways, creating a supersonic omnidirectional jet, just about the coolest triplet of words I've ever seen, that destroys everything in its path. The wall of water expands outward kilometer by kilometer, ripping up trees, houses, and topsoil as it goes. The house, porch, and old-timers are obliterated in an instant. Everything within a few kilometers is completely scoured away, leaving a pool of mud atop bedrock. The splash continues outward, demolishing all structures out to distances of 20 or 30 kilometers. At this distance, areas shielded by mountains or ridges are protected, and the flood begins to flow along natural valleys and waterways. The broader region is largely protected from the effects of the storm, though areas hundreds of kilometers downstream experience flash flooding in the hours after the impact. News trickles out into the world about the inexplicable disaster. There is widespread shock and puzzlement, and, for a while, every new cloud in the sky causes mass panic. Fear reigns supreme as the world fears rain supreme. But years pass without any signs of the disaster repeating. Atmospheric scientists try for years to piece together what happened, but no explanation is forthcoming. Eventually they give up, and the unexplained meteorological phenomenon is simply called the dubstep storm, because, in the words of one researcher, it had one hell of a drop. Chapter 55. SAT Guessing. Question. What if everyone who took the SAT guessed on every multiple-choice question? How many perfect scores would there be? Rob Balder. Answer. None. The SAT is a standardized test given to American high school students. The scoring is such that under certain circumstances, guessing an answer can be a good strategy. But what if you guessed on everything? Not all of the SAT is multiple choice, so let's focus on the multiple choice questions to keep things simple. We'll assume everyone gets the essay questions and fill in the number sections correct. In the 2014 version of the SAT, there were 44 multiple choice questions in the math quantitative section, 67 in the critical reading qualitative section, and 47 in the newfangled, I took the SAT a long time ago, okay? Writing section. Each question has five options, so a random guess has a 20% chance of being right. The probability of getting all 158 questions right is 1 over 5 to the 44th times 1 over 5 to the 67th times 1 over 5 to the 47th approximately equals 1 over 2.7 times 10 to the 110th. That's 1 in 27 quinquatrigintillion. If all 4,000,017-year-olds took the SAT, and they all guessed randomly, it's virtually certain that there would be no perfect scores on any of the three sections. How certain is it? Well, if they each used a computer to take the test a million times each day, and continued this every day for 5 billion years, until the sun expanded to a red giant and the earth was charred to a cinder, the chance of any of them ever getting a perfect score on just the math section would be about 0.0001%. How unlikely is that? Each year, something like 500 Americans are struck by lightning, based on an average of 45 lightning deaths and a 9-10% fatality rate. This suggests that the odds of any one American being hit in a given year are about 1 in 700,000. See XKCD Conditional Risk, xkcd.com/795. This means that the odds of acing the SAT by guessing are worse than the odds of every living ex-president and every member of the main cast of Firefly all being independently struck by lightning on the same day. To everyone taking the SAT this year, good luck, but it won't be enough. Chapter 56, Neutron Bullet. Question. If a bullet with the density of a neutron star were fired from a handgun, ignoring the how, at the Earth's surface, would the Earth be destroyed? Charlotte Ainsworth. Answer. A bullet with the density of a neutron star would weigh about as much as the Empire State Building. Whether we fired it from a gun or not, the bullet would fall straight through the ground, punching through the crust as if the rock were wet tissue paper. We'll look at two different questions. What would the bullet's passage do to the Earth? If we kept the bullet here on the surface, what would it do to its surroundings? Could we touch it? First, a little bit of background. What are neutron stars? A neutron star is what's left over after a giant star collapses under its own gravity. Stars exist in a balance. Their massive gravity is always trying to make them collapse inward, but that squeezing sets off several different forces that push them back apart. In the sun, the thing holding off collapse is heat from nuclear fusion. When a star runs out of fusion fuel, it contracts in a complicated process involving several explosions until the collapse is stopped by the quantum laws that keep matter from overlapping with other matter. The Pauli exclusion principle keeps electrons from getting too close to each other. This effect is one of the main reasons that your laptop doesn't fall through your lap. If the star is heavy enough, it overcomes that quantum pressure and collapses further with another, more massive explosion to become a neutron star. If the remnant is even heavier, it becomes a black hole. It's possible there's a category of objects heavier than neutron stars, but not quite heavy enough to become black holes, called strange stars. Neutron stars are some of the densest objects you can find outside of the infinite density of a black hole. They're crushed by their own immense gravity into a compact quantum mechanical soup that's in some ways similar to an atomic nucleus the size of a mountain. Is our bullet made from a neutron star? No. Charlotte asked for a bullet as dense as a neutron star, not one made from actual neutron star material. That's good, because you can't make a bullet from that stuff. If you take neutron star material outside of the crushing gravity well where it's normally found, it will re-expand into super-hot normal matter with an outpouring of energy more powerful than any nuclear weapon. That's presumably why Charlotte suggested we make our bullet out of some magical, stable material that's as dense as a neutron star. What would the bullet do to the Earth? You could imagine firing it from a gun, a magical unbreakable gun that you could hold without your arm being torn off. Don't worry, that part comes later. But it might be more interesting to simply drop it. In either case, the bullet would accelerate downward, punch into the ground, and burrow toward the center of the Earth. This wouldn't destroy the Earth, but it would be pretty strange. As the bullet got within a few feet of the ground, the force of its gravity would yank up a huge clump of dirt, which would ripple wildly around the bullet as it fell, spraying in all directions. As it went in, you'd feel the ground shake, and it would leave a jumbled, fractured crater with no entry hole. The bullet would fall straight through the Earth's crust. On the surface, the vibration would quickly die down, but far below, the bullet would be crushing and vaporizing the mantle in front of it as it fell. It would blast the material out of the way with powerful shock waves, leaving a trail of super-hot plasma behind it. This would be something never before seen in the history of the universe. An underground shooting star. Make a wish. Eventually, the bullet would come to rest, lodged in the nickel-iron core at the center of the Earth. The energy delivered to the Earth would be massive on a human scale, but the planet would barely notice. The bullet's gravity would affect only the rock within a few dozen feet of it. While it's heavy enough to fall through the crust, its gravity alone wouldn't be strong enough to crush the rock very much. The hole would close up, leaving the bullet forever out of anyone's reach, unless Kip Duran uses the force to drag it back up. Eventually, the Earth would be consumed by the aging swollen sun, and the bullet would reach its final resting place at the sun's core. The sun isn't dense enough to become a neutron star itself. After it swallows the Earth, it will instead go through some phases of expansion and collapse and will eventually settle down, leaving behind a small white dwarf star with the bullet still lodged in the center. Someday, far in the future, when the universe is thousands of times older than it is today, that white dwarf will cool and fade to black. That answers the question of what would happen if the bullet were fired into the Earth. But what if we could keep it near the surface? Set the bullet on a sturdy pedestal. First, we'd need a magical, infinitely strong pedestal to put the bullet on, which would need to sit on a similarly strong platform large enough to spread the weight out, otherwise the whole thing would sink into the ground. A base about the size of a city block would be strong enough to keep it above ground for at least a few days, probably much more. After all, the Empire State Building, which weighs as much as our bullet, rests on a similar platform, and it's more than a few days old, citation needed, and hasn't disappeared into the ground, citation needed. The bullet wouldn't vacuum up the atmosphere. It would definitely compress the air around it and warm it up a little, but surprisingly, not really enough to notice. Can I touch it? Let's imagine what would happen if you tried. The gravity from this thing is strong, but it's not that strong. Imagine you're standing 10 meters away. At this distance, you feel a very slight tug in the direction of the pedestal. Your brain, not accustomed to non-uniform gravities, thinks you're standing on a gentle slope. This perceived slope gets steeper as you walk toward the pedestal, as if the ground were tipping forward. When you get to within a few meters, you have a hard time not sliding forward. However, if you've got a good grip on something, a handle or a signpost, you can get pretty close. Los Alamos physicists might call this tickling the dragon's tail. But I want to touch it! To get close enough to touch it, you would need a very good grip on something. Really, you'd need to do this in a full-body support harness, or at the very least, a neck brace. If you get to within reach, your head will weigh as much as a small child, and your blood won't know which way to flow. However, if you're a fighter pilot who's used to G-forces, you might be able to pull it off. From this angle, the blood is rushing to your head, but you'd still be able to breathe. As you stretch out your arm, the pull gets a lot stronger. 20 centimeters, about 8 inches, is the point of no return. As your fingertips cross that line, your arm becomes too heavy to pull back. If you do a lot of one-handed pull-ups, you might be able to go a little closer. Once you get to within a few inches, the force on your fingers is overwhelming, and they're yanked forward, with or without you, and your fingertips actually touch the bullet, probably dislocating your fingers and shoulder. When your fingertip actually comes in contact with the bullet, the pressure in your fingertips becomes too strong, and your blood breaks through the skin. In Firefly, River Tam famously commented that the human body can be drained of blood in 8.6 seconds given adequate vacuuming systems. By touching the bullet, you've just created an adequate vacuuming system. Your body is restrained by a harness, and your arm remains attached to your body. Flesh is surprisingly strong. But blood pours from your fingertip much faster than ordinarily possible. River's 8.6 seconds might be an overestimate. Then things get weird. The blood wraps around the bullet, forming a glowing dark red sphere whose surface hums and vibrates with ripples moving too fast to see. But wait! There's a fact that now becomes important. You float on blood. As the blood sphere grows, the force on your shoulder weakens because the parts of your fingertips below the surface of the blood are buoyant. Blood is denser than flesh, and half the weight on your arm was coming from the last two knuckles of your fingers. When the blood is a few centimeters deep, the load gets considerably lighter. If you could wait for the sphere of blood to get 20 centimeters deep, and if your shoulder were intact, you might even be able to pull your arm away. Problem, that would take 5 times as much blood as you have in your body. It looks like you're not going to make it. Let's rewind. How to touch a neutron bullet, salt, water, and vodka. You can touch the bullet and survive, but you need to surround it with water. If you want to be really clever, you can dangle the end of the hose in the water and let the bullet's gravity do the siphoning for you. To touch the bullet, pour water onto the pedestal until it's a meter or two deep on the side of the bullet. It will form a shape like a dome or a bell curve. Now, dip your head and arm in. Thanks to the water, you're able to wave your hand around the bullet without any difficulty. The bullet is pulling you toward it, but it's pulling the water just as hard. Water, like meat, is virtually incompressible, even at these pressures, so nothing critical gets crushed. When you pull your arm out, watch for symptoms of decompression sickness due to nitrogen bubbles in the blood vessels in your hand. However, you may not quite be able to touch the bullet. When your fingers get a few millimeters away, the powerful gravity means that buoyancy plays a gigantic role. If your hand is slightly less dense than the water, it won't be able to penetrate that last millimeter. If it's slightly more dense, it will be sucked down. This is where the vodka and salt come in. If you find the bullet tugging on your fingertips as you reach in, it means your fingers aren't buoyant enough. Mix in some salt to make the water denser. If you find your fingertips sliding on an invisible surface at the edge of the bullet, make the water less dense by adding vodka. If you got the balance just right, you could touch the bullet and live to tell about it. Maybe. Alternative plan. Sound too risky to you? No problem. This whole plan, the bullet, the water, the salt, the vodka, doubles as instructions for making the most difficult mixed drink in the history of beverages, the Neutron Star. So grab a straw and take a drink. And remember, if someone drops a cherry into your Neutron Star and it sinks to the bottom, don't try to fish it out. It's gone. Weird and worrying questions from the What If inbox, number 12. Question. What if I swallow a tick that has Lyme disease? Will my stomach acid kill the tick and the borreliosis? Or would I get Lyme disease from the inside out? Christopher Vogel. Just to be safe, you should swallow something to kill the tick, like Solanopsis germinata, tropical fire ant. Then swallow a Pseudactian curvatus fly to kill the ant. Next, find a spider. Question. Assuming a relatively uniform resonant frequency in a passenger jet, how many cats meowing at what resonant frequency of said jet would be required to bring it down? Brittany. Hello, FAA. Is there a Brittany on the no-fly list? Yes, with cats. That sounds like her. Okay, just making sure you were aware. Chapter 57, Richter 15. Question. What if a Richter magnitude 15 earthquake were to hit America at, let's say, New York City? What about a Richter 20? 25? Alec Farid. Answer. The Richter scale, which has technically been replaced by the moment magnitude scale, measures the energy released by an earthquake. Similarly, the F scale, Fujita scale, has been replaced by the EF scale, enhanced Fujita. Sometimes a unit of measure is made obsolete because it is terrible. For example, KIPS, 1,000 pounds force, KFCS, thousands of cubic feet per second, and degrees Rankine, degrees Fahrenheit above absolute zero. I have had to read technical papers written in each of those units. Other times, you get the sense that scientists just want something to correct people about. It's an open-ended scale, but since we usually hear about earthquakes with ratings from 3 to 9, a lot of people probably think of 10 as the top and 1 as the bottom. In fact, 10 isn't the top of the scale, but it might as well be. A magnitude 9 earthquake already measurably alters the rotation of the Earth. The two magnitude 9 plus earthquakes this century both altered the length of the day by a tiny fraction of a second. A magnitude 15 earthquake would involve the release of almost 10 to the 32nd joules of energy, which is roughly the gravitational binding energy of the Earth. To put it another way, the Death Star caused a magnitude 15 earthquake on Alderaan. The Alderaan Geologic Survey has confirmed that a magnitude 15 earthquake has turned all their seismometers to expanding vapor. You could, in theory, have a more powerful earthquake on Earth, but in practice, all it would mean is that the expanding cloud of debris would be hotter. The Sun, with its higher gravitational binding energy, could have a magnitude 20 quake, although it would certainly trigger some kind of catastrophic nova. The most powerful quakes in the known universe, which occur in the material in a super-heavy neutron star, are about this magnitude. This is about the energy release you would get if you packed the entire volume of the Earth with hydrogen bombs and detonated them all at once.
What if we tried less power?
We spend a lot of time talking about things that are large and violent. But what about the bottom end of the scale? Is there such thing as a magnitude 0 earthquake? Yes. In fact, the scale goes all the way down past 0. Let's take a look at some low-magnitude earthquakes with a description of what they would be like if they hit your house. magnitude 0. The Dallas Cowboys running at full tilt into the side of your neighbor's garage. Magnitude minus 1. A single football player running into a tree in your yard. Magnitude minus 2. A cat falling off a dresser. Magnitude minus 3. A cat knocking your cell phone off your nightstand. Magnitude minus 4. A penny falling off a dog. Seismologists are confirming that a penny has fallen off a dog. Magnitude minus 5. A key press on an IBM Model M keyboard. Magnitude minus 6. A key press on a lightweight keyboard. Magnitude minus 7. A single feather fluttering to the ground. Magnitude minus 8. A grain of fine sand falling onto the pile at the bottom of a tiny hourglass. And let's jump all the way down to magnitude minus 15. A drifting mote of dust coming to rest on a table. Sometimes it's nice not to destroy the world for a change. This concludes the reading of What If? Serious Scientific Answers to Absurd Hypothetical Questions by Randall and Rowe. Copyright 2014 by XKCD Incorporated. This book was read by Will Wheaton. This unabridged recording was published by arrangement with the Gerner Company and was produced in 2014 by Blackstone Audio, Inc., which holds the copyright. Neither this recording nor any portion of it may be reproduced or used for any purpose without prior written authorization from Blackstone Audio, Inc. If you would like to obtain a monthly update telling you about new releases, call 1-800-SAY-BOOK. That's 1-800-729-2665. For a complete listing of our titles, visit our website at www.downpour.com. Thank you.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.